Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2021 for what will be the final stream on this, the 16th night. I believe this is the 16th night. Let me just make sure. Yes, it is. So, unfortunately, Milo has had to cancel. We'll try to reschedule it. We'll see what happens. But anyway, so I am here with... Now, let me make sure that I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Is it Brett... well, you tell me.
Brittany. You were getting there, yeah.
Okay, Brittany. Okay. Brittany Schaffer.
Schaefer.
So would you like to introduce yourself to the audience, please?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I'll start kind of at the very beginning. I was born into kind of a radical libertarian family. My dad was Butler Schaefer. I don't know if you've read any of his stuff. He's written books and a lot of articles and things. So I was kind of steeped in that whole world, and you know, until college, when I went to back then a very, very left-wing college, UC Santa Cruz, back when, you know, not all universities in America had gone full communist. This one had, so I kind of got to spar quite a lot with them and test out my ideas against their ideas. I didn't finish college. I went to Hong Kong as a in my junior year, and then went back again after I fled college. Went back, lived in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Japan for about 10 years altogether, and most of that time as a journalist. So I was writing about mostly political economic stuff. So, you know, I got to see the economic reforms in China and up close, and the kind of economic collapse in 98, 99. And then came back to the States, and I've been writing, got married in 2005, and now have a wonderful teenage son and a daughter who has a genetic condition. She has an intellectual disability and seizures. But I still write. I've written this, which I think everybody should get, Annabelle Pickering and the Sky Pirates, which is an adventure story, sort of Harry Potter age, but that deals with big issues like, you know, the individual versus the state, society versus the state, freedom of information, and how to distinguish between what's true and what you're being told and that kind of thing. And I recently started a mutual aid society. It's a private membership association.
We'll get to that later.
Okay. So that's me. Sorry.
Okay. So it sounds like you said that you were born into a libertarian, radical libertarian household. Would you say that you have maintained those ideas from your, that were passed down to you from your parents? It sounds like you have.
I guess I've retained my belief in individual liberty. I think what's changed is that my parents, at least, you know, when I was young, what was sort of given to me was this very intellectual, ideas-based value system, where it was, you know, I believe in individual liberty because it's right. And what, you know, after years of kind of being in the world, and especially as a journalist and sort of looking at comparative systems, looking at a socialist economy right next door to like the most free market enclave in the world, getting to see how those ideas play out in the real world kind of, I guess, gave me more of a grounding in how those intellectual ideas work in reality.
So would you say that your parents' ideas were largely academic? And I'm interested because it sounds like I can imagine that back then it wasn't quite as obviously it's a different social situation, different, slightly different culture in America. Would you say that it was easier or harder then to be a libertarian? How do you think this
that's
relates?
An interesting question, because you know, back then there were so much fewer of us. I mean, it was, you know, Murray Rothbard used to say you could fit all the libertarians into one in the country, into one apartment in New York City, and that's kind of the culture that my dad came from. So in that sense it was harder because there were fewer people, But what was different about back then was that you could have conversations across belief groups. I could have conversations with hardcore leftists or with, you know, hardcore conservatives. And it hadn't gotten to this point of just shutting out. I did experience some of that at my university. I with some friends had started this alternative newspaper to sort of have conservative and libertarian ideas. And the response to that was that people would just pick up stacks of them and throw them in the garbage. And that kind of thing. I mean, and, you know, if you tried to speak at one of their events, this was when the anti-apartheid movement was going on. And a good friend of mine tried to speak and give the sort of non-standard left-wing position on that. And he was basically removed from the hall. So that kind of thing was going on in certain circles, but it wasn't as, you know, now it's everywhere. Now it's everything. You can't escape that. So I would say in the population generally, you could still have civil conversations, even though, you know, we were a tiny, tiny minority. So yeah, it's a little bit of both.
Do you think the radical left was also less numerous in those days?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, they were definitely at my university. There were a number of them, you know, budding radicals. But certainly, yeah, now, out in the world at large, no, it wasn't common.
Because they just seem to be everywhere now. Just part of daily life, whereas I think, you know, 30 years ago it was fringe politics, but now leftist fringe politics has become the mainstream at this point.
Yeah, well, I think they slowly, you know, what I saw them doing was they sort of appropriated notions of community and compassion and all of these good things that we all want to be. And they, over time, appropriated those as their own. And so, you know, as time goes on, it's like they can just, you know, push out their agenda, but still claim it under this banner of, well, we're the kind, compassionate ones.
Oh, yeah.
And now that's starting to really fall apart. I mean, I don't think they can maintain. I mean, I'm surprised they can still maintain it. But, you know, that's kind of crumbling.
Why would you say it's crumbling? I mean, obviously, I could answer this question myself, but I think it's, you're the interviewee. So why do you think that the left no longer seem compassionate or are compassionate?
I mean, for so many reasons. I mean, one, you know, I live in California, and you can just look at, yeah, I know. You can just look at what the leftist policies have done to this state. It's really, and in these last couple of years especially, you know, for example, homelessness, you know, they have, it is impossible, I mean, literally impossible to legally build affordable housing in Los Angeles or in San Francisco. I mean, you can't follow their rules and build something that an ordinary person can live in. And then there's rent control and there's all this other stuff. So they have these tightly, tightly managed cities. And then they're surprised that nobody can afford to live there. And that, you know, that it's not just drug addicts who are homeless now. I mean, if you look at the last few years, homeless populations where I in Los Angeles, it's frightening because, you know, you'll be driving along and see people who look like they could have been at an office job, you know, a couple of days ago. It's not.
Well, that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And so, you know, yeah, I get that not everybody puts, you know, connects the dots on that. But, you know, there's the homelessness, there's the fires here, which are largely because of mismanagement by the state. And then, of course, you know, all the COVID stuff. And it's just, I guess if you are a hardcore leftist, you can keep going along with the idea that, oh, we stand for, you know, love and compassion and all this stuff. But the reality is crumbling around them. I mean, California is becoming this disaster zone.
You know, I was there in 5 years ago, November 2016. And even then, and I remember I kept remarking on it to different people, how it, even then, it seemed like it was from the 80s. It seemed like it hadn't really changed. And I liked it for that. You know, it was exciting. It was kind of novelty. You'd seen neon signs everywhere, which I hadn't seen for like 10, 15 years. And there was dilapidation. So it kind of looked like, it was weird. It was like walking into an 80s movie. Like the same styles, that sort of shop frontages. I can't even remember where this was. It was near San Francisco. I can't be more precise than that. It was a very, it really struck me again and again. And I guess that it's got worse since then. I mean, this is what I've heard from people.
Yeah, well, and the other part of that is that, you know, the smart people have all left. So, you know, I mean, there's a huge, huge, if it was a third world country, you'd call it a brain drain. You know, huge exodus from California to Texas, Florida, all these other places. And so, you know, I just wonder what, you know, and we're leaving too. I wonder what it's going to look like a couple of years from now. It has just gotten worse. And, you know, I think part of it is, you know, when you're living in the middle of a situation like that, you keep telling yourself, well, it can't get that much worse. You know, it's not going to, they can't, oh, this is crazy. They can't possibly push it any further. And then they do. So I think,
that's been the case over the last 2 years again and again.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and not only in California, it's just that California is such, you know, it's the poster child for all the craziness that's going on.
It seems to be, as you say, the epicenter for all that. I mean, I remember people saying what happens in California happens in the rest of America 10 years later, and then happens in Britain 10 years after that. That was the case, you know, a while ago.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we didn't leave early on, because I felt like, you know, and especially with the COVID stuff, because this is being brought on by people with a global agenda. And so I just felt like, well, yeah, we could leave and buy ourselves some time, but the reality is these people want the whole world. And so where, you know, isn't it better to stay and fight where you are, rather than just go and buy a little more time and get comfortable. And what finally made the decision for us was just, you know, we've got a teenage son and he can't have a life right now. I mean, it's impossible to do the things that normal kids do. You just can't do it unless you're going to get their vaccine and go along with the whole thing. So
I can only imagine how prescriptive it all must be in California now with the vaccine stuff. Well, not just that. I mean, everything. It must be like a police state.
It is. And the worst thing about it is, so we live in Burbank, which is like, it's an incorporated city within Los Angeles. So a lot of the things that have been declared for Los Angeles, like the vaccine mandate stuff, it's not part of Burbank. And yet you see places going along with it anyway. And what, to me, what's most horrifying about it is just that, is seeing the extent to which so many of the people around us not only accept it, but like are enthusiastic about it. And it, you know, I spent time in Asia and I met people who had lived through the Cultural Revolution, and this just, it has all the markings of that. You know, it's this campaign that's being served up to people, not only so that the people can be the victims of it, but so that they can be the perpetrators of it too. And so it's, you know, neighbor against neighbor, and, you know, family member against family member, and all this stuff. And it's just, how do you fight that?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I saw the film The Killing Fields about Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And there were numerous very disturbing sort of inhuman things that the Khmer Rouge did. And one of them was that children were all raised by the party, and also the children executed the adults, which is just
about that.
Unbelievably perverse. And yeah, I mean, obviously we're not there yet. Obviously, I'm not equating this with that, but there is a sense of that they, as you say, they get the people to abuse them, the people, which breaks down all these ties, these different structures, social structures that would have been there before.
Yeah. Well, and they go after the deepest social structures. In China, it was they really made an effort to pit family members against family members. And one of the things that, you know, that it was known for was getting children to turn in their parents. You know, if you hear your parents having a conversation that might not be completely politically correct, you know, which is a Maoist term, by the way, that you would have to turn them in. And children would do this enthusiastically. And it's just, you know, when you think it's happening at such a level, it's not just about like the material or physical suffering, although that was inflicted too. It's like this getting into your psyche and attacking people at a deep, deep level.
And, you know, we've seen this with COVID, obviously not children mm-hmm. reporting their parents to for thought crime, but we have seen families being split apart, you know, siblings no longer speaking to each other. Yeah. Now, I can imagine that with the climate change agenda, when that mm-hmm. is enacted, I can imagine it going to that level where children are being encouraged to, you know, correct their parents' thinking. And if your parent says something that you think is insensitive to the mm-hmm. environment, maybe let a teacher know about that. Yeah, I can imagine it happening in more cuddly, sort of cozy, roundabout ways, but amounting to exactly the same thing, because then the teacher reports them to the social services and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It sounds ridiculous, but COVID would have sounded ridiculous 2 years
ago. Everything we've been through over the last 2 years would have sounded ridiculous 2.5 years ago.
Nobody would have believed you. If you'd said in 2019 that what's going to happen, no one would have believed you. Yeah. So I think that we should be very careful about thinking that anything is off the table, that anything is too extreme to happen.
Yeah.
So one of the things you've given me some broad points. Saving civilization. How would you define civilization personally?
I guess.
It's actually quite a difficult one, isn't it?
It's
not just the systems of society. That
no, it's not. More... It's. I'm trying to think in terms of what's the result. I mean, I know what I think the systems are that are needed for it. But the question you're asking is, what's the result? What's the end result? What does that look like? So, I mean, just to give an example, I've lived in Hong Kong and I've lived in Japan. And Japan is the most civilized society I've ever lived in. And what I mean by that is, and I'm not saying that every civilization has to look like Japan. That's not what I mean. It's that, you know, it's peaceful. You can walk around and not be in fear of being assaulted or have, you know, in the case of Japan, you can leave expensive camera equipment on the train station bench, and not only will, you know, it not be stolen, somebody will probably hunt you down to give it back to you. That actually happened to me once, not with camera equipment, but something else.
I've heard similar things from other people who have been there. They're sort of amazed at how orderly and civilized and polite and well-run and responsible everyone is and all this.
And it's an awareness. It's you get there and you can like feel the awareness of the people around you. Like you can feel them watching you, not in a bad or threatening way, but just that they're very aware and they're aware of everyone's space. They're very conscientious about not, you know, intruding on other people's space. And yet if they see someone who needs help, they're going to go in there and offer help. Sorry, it's going off. It's a whole different mindset. Not even mindset. It's like a whole different level of awareness. So when I say civilization, I guess I mean a platform or a structure within which people can live at peace with each other, where they can be free to create, because I think that's why we're here, is so that we can create. And I guess a structure where people don't have to live in fear and can be free to be the best that we can be. That's, to me, that's what civilization is. And it doesn't have to mean, you know, this, the same in every location. In fact, I don't think that can exist. I don't think you can have a single image of civilization replicated all over the world. I think it's different from place to place, but that same thing of establishing a platform where people can be free, where they can basically feel safe and, you know, are prosperous enough that they can, you know, be creative in their lives and do, you know, make the best of themselves.
Yeah, it is. I would share that definition, but I mean, there's obviously more to it about history, the future, an awareness of these things, a systematized way, because otherwise you could have, I mean, there's a distinction between a civilization and a local tribal culture, which can mm-hmm. have a lot of going for it. But a civilization is something else. But I think there's a certain detachment as well as probably part of being civilized, a certain ability to not get too excited, too involved, an ability to see the bigger picture. I think that's part of being civilized. And so civilization would obviously be something that nurtured that. But again, now, here and now, see, this is another thing that I think is being damaged by COVID, because I think they don't want people to have breathing space. They don't want people to be detached. They want people to be hysterical and to immediately attack the unknown or the non-conformant, the unorthodox, whatever. So they're actually attacking that as, I mean, because some people would say, well, this is civilized. This is the end product of civilization. It's all these systems in place and we're detached from the earth and divorced from Mother Nature and so on. So this is the ultimate civilization, what we're going through now. I don't think that's true. I think this is a perversion of civilization.
Yeah. And I think as far as being attached to the earth, I feel like a healthy civilization does have that element of being connected to the earth, because I think that's, you know, we as just as human beings, as these, you know, the creatures that we are, I think we need that. And I don't see civilization. I think there's this sort of sci-fi view of civilization as being totally detached and living out in, you know, space pods somewhere. But we're part of this earth. We evolved to interact with nature and to, you know, to be a part of this earth, not to live in some aluminum capsule out in orbit or something. So, you know, not that you can't have civilization also out in space, but
be a different thing altogether, wouldn't it? I mean,
it would. You know. And I just, there are so many dimensions to it. There are so many, you know, there's the spiritual, there's the physiological, there's all this stuff that we need as humans. And I guess the piece about civilization that I didn't mention was it builds on itself. So over generations, you build civilizational capital, you know, you build systems. And so, for example, one of the things that I'm kind of really getting into right now is common law. You know, we have this common law tradition that was developed over hundreds of years, probably, I guess, thousands of years, maybe. Maybe not thousands of years, but... And the way that it works really facilitates what I'm talking about, you know, a platform where people can live at peace and resolve disputes and, you know, function and not be in fear all the time. I feel like that. So in my country, I'm not sure how exactly it works where you are, but in my country, we're founded on a common law basis. We have the Constitution, which sort of upholds common law values, individual rights, limitations on what the state can do in the pursuit of criminals and things like that. And then we have administrative law, which to me, the two are just completely at odds. I mean,
The common law, I believe, originated in Britain. It's English common law. So I think that was transplanted to America. I mean, I don't know the history, but I believe that's the case. And yeah, it's very separate things. So, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, well, so I was just going to say the administrative law or statutory law is basically, so common law is kind of, I'm oversimplifying, but it's kind of, came about throughout the process of people resolving their own disputes, finding a third party to be a judge and say, hey, would you adjudicate this for us? And this guy is saying, okay, well, let me look at how this was resolved in the past. And then we developed this base of case law to refer to resolve future disputes. So it's this organic process of building a law based on how people interact and based on their needs and wants. Statutory law is kind of when a bunch of politicians sit in a room and say, how do we want to design society from the top down? What do we want these creatures to do? And, you know, just as importantly, what do the people funding us want them to do? So it's a totally different process.
And again, this is another thing that I see really taking hold now. Over the last 2 years, I've mentioned before about big tech, how you have one sort of moment of agency in your interactions with a large corporation today, and that is the moment when you choose to accept the terms of the end user license agreement or not. Often that choice is not really a real choice, because you've got to. That you need that thing, and there is no rival to it, there's no substitute for it, so you need that thing, so you have to accept the terms. But once you have accepted the terms, that's it, you're playing by their rules, and there is no ability to for you to negotiate with them, if there's a dispute, you launch an appeal, they can just ignore it, they don't have to do anything. And I think on the one hand, this is a natural way for a global corporation to handle vast numbers of customers, users. But it's also a very dehumanizing way for them to do it, because there is no direct contact between the end user and a human being at the corporation. And I think this is the way that things are going in. I mean, that's big tech these large corporations, but I think it's probably... governments governance bodies will have realized that that's actually a very useful way to deal with the public, because it makes things simple, and you don't have to deal with their complaints, really. You can just treat them however you want. As long as you've got them to agree to the terms, that's that.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about the lack of accountability. You know, there's that's central to any government, is, you know, that's sort of what it does, is it wraps itself in these layers so that no individual is accountable for what they do. But corporations do it too, especially if they're in bed with the government and they can kind of get its protection. But that's sort of what's central here, is that these big entities, they don't want to be accountable. Why would they? And so we need to find ways to make them accountable. And that's, I don't know if you're familiar with like the notice of liability movement. Where I am, and also in the UK, a lot of people are starting to send notices of liability, not to a corporation and not to a government, but to individuals. So for example, and this kind of started with people who were concerned about like cell towers and Wi-Fi in their neighborhoods. And because local jurisdictions would put up these layers to protect themselves from any kind of accountability, people started sending a notice of liability to the individual city council members who approved this project and saying, hey, you're violating my rights. This is potentially harmful to me and my family. You need to stop, or blah, blah, blah. And it's a legal document. You know, whether a court is going to uphold it or not is up to the court, but it's something that some people have had success with. I know someone who was able to get cell towers removed from her jurisdiction. But what I was getting at was, this is one way, and we need to be finding ways to hold the individuals accountable, because we're in a situation, you know, similar. I'm not equating this to the Holocaust, but it's similar to what people were tried for at Nuremberg. You know, they were following the rules. They were going along with this system that protected them from accountability. And yet at some point someone broke through and said, no, you don't get to just murder people because that's your terms of service. You know, you've got to, at some point, we're going to hold you accountable. And so I feel like that we need to be looking for the ways to hold these criminals accountable.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is all about, I don't want to say anything Fed posty here, but they clearly do feel that they can do what they like. A good example of this is the vaccine, the COVID vaccine. Airlines, they can decide, okay, this is going to be our policy. And it doesn't matter how many relationships we make impossible by demanding this vaccine. It doesn't matter how many families we break up by doing this. It doesn't matter even how many businesses we make fail because of this. This is our policy. And there is no, and I'm sure that you could look into this and find that there have been bribes from Big Pharma and from digital ID companies. Nothing would surprise me at all.
Yeah.
But this is the kind of thing that it infuriates me. Again, the last 2 years, everything has changed. It was already on the way. You could see prefigurings of it, but it's all become much clearer now. And so there is no way to negotiate. I mean, the only way that this has to change in the sense that I think we need dedicated organizations who find out what is the best way to deal with this corporation and that corporation and that corporation. Who are the movers and shakers here? What are their procedures? What rules or what requests can they not say no to? Things like that. We need to pull that sort of information and organize it, index it. Because otherwise, everyone who has some kind of dispute with any of these companies is starting from square one and is on their own.
Yeah, and some people are doing things like that. But the other thing, you know, and the notices of liability approach deals with that in a way, because it's doing the research to find out who's the individual who made this call, whose name is on this letter saying that this is their policy. Because you dig long enough and you're going to find somebody, whether it's a CEO or person in charge of such and such department, you're going to find an individual. And we really need to be holding individuals accountable, because individuals are the ones who ultimately make the decisions and who can change things. And they're not going to if they don't have an incentive. I mean, you know, these big airlines, they don't care about your family. They don't care about, you know, you getting to see a relative who's in a hospital or someone's wedding or something. Why should they care about that? They don't. We have to find ways to make them care. But then the other piece of that, and which is also already happening, is we need to start building our own alternatives. We need to start, you know, I don't know if you know the organization FAFTA, it's Freedom Airways. And then the larger organization is, I think, FAFTA, but they're looking at setting up their own airline. They're looking at setting up ways to travel legally, you know, not, you know, they don't want to get shot down. But they're looking at ways to create options for travel for people who don't want to go along with all that stuff. And there are, and that's kind of what the private membership association that I was talking about earlier, that's what that does too. It's a way of getting out of the statutory system and having the freedom to create alternatives. I mean, hospitals here in this country, where you are too, I think, have just become a nightmare. You know, they're taking people in and not allowing anyone to be with them. They're essentially killing people by neglect in a lot of cases. People here are afraid to go to hospitals. So we need to create hospitals. We need to build alternatives that are not going to play that game.
Yeah. Do you think ultimately it's going to require creating our own countries?
That's a good question. Effectively, yes, but they may not be geographically. I mean, effectively, I think what I'm talking about is creating our own jurisdictions, and how people organize those, I think, will look different from place to place and from group to group. There are already online, there are people sort of setting up online communities that act like, I don't want to say act like countries, but that do their own conflict resolution, that have their own currency, that encourage people to trade with each other, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a good question. And I feel like the real answer is yes, but that those countries might not look like what we think of as countries today.
That is an interesting notion. Do you think sort of virtual countries?
Partly, yes, but not really, not entirely. I think the things, and you know, I could be wrong about this, but I think the countries or the communities that are going to survive will have some kind of local connection. Will have some kind of. I feel like the in-person aspect of community is really important, and that's why they've tried shutting it down. That's why they've worked so hard to shut it down. So I really don't think that what's going to emerge out of all this will be totally online communities. I feel like the strongest communities are going to be a mix of both.
I think that's true. Obviously, it's the best way for people to organize just now.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. I mean, we can't... IRL, as we call it in real life, comes with a lot of hazards, especially from Antifa. I mean, I can remember when Antifa turned violent, and it was really the start of 2017, maybe earlier, but I wasn't aware of it before then. And I remember an American guy actually saying to me, Antifa isn't really a thing over here, as opposed to Europe. And then throughout the Trump presidency, they just became bolder and bolder and more violent, you know, culminating probably last summer, which was with just insane rioting and vandalism. And of course, the authorities letting them away with it. So this is the danger with anything real life. The state will just send these shock troops in to mess it up.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at it is we're kind of we're being colonized. You know, where it's you know, when you look at the British Empire and how it behaved towards the people that it colonized, well, that's what this feels like. You know, they want to control us. They want us to be sort of under their boot, and they certainly don't want us getting together and forming our own societies. So yeah, that's totally
our business. Yeah, and the thing I go back to here is, do you know about a YouTuber called Vosh?
No, I don't think so.
He's a center-left guy. I think he would even call himself a neoliberal. And he has actually said that if a state in America tried to secede, he would support it invading it and installing a regime change. And this is something that I think is quite difficult for libertarians to grasp, but also just traditionalists who tend to think that the left is like they were in the 90s, where they were just happy-go-lucky, live and let live, etc. At this stage, they're actually very imperialistic, for want of a better word. They can't thole the idea of people living in a way that they don't approve of, which is usually the most mainstream way, which involves, you know, transgender kids. And
well, and they've changed mainstream to mean something totally different too. I think I recognized this early on just in my conversations with people on the left back in the 90s, even if they weren't coming out and saying it explicitly, the at least the ones who were wedded to socialism, because you can't have a socialist economy without forcing it on people. It's not, you know, yeah, people could get together and decide to be socialist in their own little group, but you can't have it across the board without using force. And their whole ideology really rests on centrally imposed violence. And it's just, you know, it's just becoming clear. Becoming clearer now. But they're not ashamed of it. They're just like the example you gave. It's like they're in their minds, I think they have the moral high ground, and so anything they propose is legitimate and good, and those who oppose it are, you know, from the Dark Ages and cretins and all that. But to me, it's becoming so blatant that and I also feel like there's, you know, yeah, they've become emboldened, but that doesn't mean they represent the majority. That doesn't mean that they really represent the mainstream. I feel like there are a lot of people who are just not as outspoken as some of us, but who recognize something's not quite right, and maybe this isn't the train we want to be on.
For sure. I mean, there is this hysteria. You know, it's I think that the far left, which, let's say, they might not be the mainstream, but they rule the mainstream. They dominate mm-hmm. it. They don't seem to have a reverse gear or, you know, brakes. It's like it's full steam ahead, especially now that they've been given a sort of go-ahead by the big corporations. You know, an anecdote here is I knew a woman who, a baby boomer generation, who was a communist and still calls herself a communist, even though she's on a big salary and has a big car and goes on multiple vacations every year. And she said just before Brexit, she put up this thing on Facebook where she said, it was a sort of, she was sharing it from elsewhere, and it said, all of these corporations have said that Brexit will be bad for the economy. And I remember thinking, that is so strange that you are a communist. In some ways, she definitely is a leftist. She's definitely, I've heard her multiple times like pouring scorn on the rich and so on. She's in very sort of resentment. And yet here she is taking the word of the corporations, of global corporations.
Some kind of authority.
Yeah, exactly. And a moral force as well. Not just an authority, but morally just. Right. That was a strange moment. I think that was, well, that would have been 2016.
Well, the thing is, I think we've gotten to a point where intellectual coherence doesn't matter that much. I mean, it does to some of us, but in the wider sphere, it doesn't have to make sense. You know, people kind of there, it's, and maybe more so where I live, but everything has been dumbed down to such a level. And the conversation has become so emotional and just rage filled that, and it's really more about having, you know, you're going to identify yourself to your fellow people by having the right attitude. Not by having an intellectually coherent argument, but by saying the right things, by hating the right people, by making the right sounds and the right kind of apologies to certain groups and all that stuff. It has nothing to do with reason. But I think the silver lining about that is all of this is becoming so apparent that I think it's pulling more people like from the true center, to the extent that there's like a center of people who aren't attached to any ideology. I think more and more of them are starting to see that that whole world view is just broken.
You see, the way I see this is something that's been revealed over the last 2 years, but before that as well, is that rationality really is not part of most people's lives. It's part of their, like, they handle their own personal lives with rationality most of the time. But when it comes to society or culture, rationality just seems to go out the window. They don't seem to, and this is my one of my problems with libertarianism. I think it presupposes that people are rational and that they want to be rational and that they're capable of it. I don't think they are. I don't think they're interested.
I don't think they are either. I'm not sure that's a problem with libertarianism. I guess it depends which libertarians you're talking about. It's absolutely true that people, and I don't think this is necessarily a new thing. You know, most likely throughout history, and other people have made this point, it's not the deep thinkers or the really, you know, the people who could compose a really strong argument that helped the tribe to survive. It was the people with the sharpest instincts or the best muscles, or, you know, it was other stuff. And so I do think we need to come to terms with, yeah, the people are not rational all the time. They can be. The question is, what do we do about that?
Well, my own thing is, I think that you have to take control. I think that people clearly need. Okay, I think that people need something to follow, some power center in society, whether it's a political party or a subculture or a religion, or a union. They need something, because most of them don't want and either are not capable or are not willing to take charge and make these decisions for themselves. So they want to follow. And this is the issue with libertarianism. I think it presupposes that most people do want to be independent.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Yeah, yeah.
And the other problem with it is that libertarians tend to shy from power for this reason. They think that, well, I couldn't violate everyone else. But what if, obviously, I'm not saying we should violate people, but what if people want to be led? Then,
right, I mean, that's
because then if you refuse to take charge, someone else will just come in and do it instead.
Yeah, I mean, that is the conundrum. You know, we live in a world where most people really don't care about freedom. I mean, they don't want to, and you're right. I mean, it's more work. I don't think it necessarily is more work to be responsible for your own life, but there's this seductive illusion put out by the politicians that they'll take care of you and everything will be fine. And, you know, you don't have to work so hard. So people buy that and they don't recognize what it's taking from them, you know, until it's too late. But yeah, so my view on that is that, yeah, the people around us, a lot of them are always going to want a leader. They're going to want someone to follow. They're going to want a religion, a cult. They're going to want something that can give them answers and that can do the hard thinking work for them. And I think that's always going to be the case. I think that's what we have as the human condition. So then those of us who do want to be free, I'm not sure exactly what the answer is, but I think part of it is, I think we need to take control in the sense of coming up with ways to prevent, if you know, people are going to get in power in, you know, the Klan over there or whatever, we need to come up with ways to protect ourselves from that. So, yeah. Yeah. You know, that's the big question, right? Is even if we create our libertarian enclave or whatever kind of enclave you want, and we follow common law, let's say it's a common law jurisdiction, and that's what, we don't even have a president, we don't even have governors or anything like that. It's just, you know, maybe there's a sheriff, I don't know, but there are, you know, judges, and it's a jurisdiction that most closely matches a libertarian ideal. Let's say we have that. then we've got all these other crazy people who don't want that and who, you know, have no problem pillaging, you know, other groups. So the question is, how do we protect ourselves from that without becoming that?
Well, yeah, I guess that, but the other problem is you'd have to have a population who were all of a libertarian mind in order, because otherwise, well, what would happen is that they would actually seek, that they might say to them, yeah, I'm a libertarian, I don't want anyone ruling me. But then they subconsciously do look for things to follow.
I mean, as we've seen in the last 2 years. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
See, I don't think that it's really about people being tricked into this. I mean, they are tricked into it in practice, but I think they're tricked into it, like politicians claiming to care about them and whatever, because it's part of their core nature anyway to want this. I think that hierarchy is built.
Yeah, that's why it works. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And now that's not to say it's free of corruption or whatever, but it. I think, as I said, if you refuse to take power, then somebody else will instead of you. So obviously that many of us are not fit for power.
What do you mean by power?
Well, authority.
But authority over what? Over the whole world?
No, just your own society. If you don't influence your own society, then other people will, because there's a vacuum. There's an influence vacuum, a power vacuum, an authority vacuum. I think nature abhors a vacuum. And I think that applies to human nature as well, actually.
What if we're talking about a society, you know, a geographically limited society, starting with people who do, or let's even say, in order to be part of the society, you have to sign an agreement that you sign on to these values, and then you can be part of the society. If you violate those values, you're out of the society. What would power look like in that kind of situation?
I don't know, because you'd have to be monitoring people's values. And that's a bit of a.
This is why I like common law, because it's not really dependent on top down. It you could call it a system of control, but it's not dependent on top down control. It's more of a system for people to resolve their disputes. Look at the Amish. I don't know enough about them, but it's not an authoritarian society, but there is, you know, there is some authoritarianism there, but it's not really, my sense of it is it's not really a top down kind of society. So what are the structures that they have? I feel like we need to be looking at sort of horizontal structures like common law rather than trying to, because, you know, if you think you can use the one ring for yourself, you're going to screw everything up, basically.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think that there is a limit to how much power any one person can handle, because, it will get to them. It will corrupt them. But what I would ask you is, what is the problem with top-down authority?
I don't believe anyone should have the power to rule over anyone else. Which doesn't mean I don't believe in law. Doesn't mean I don't believe in people being held accountable for their actions. But I don't believe there's a difference between a system of laws and a system of rulership. So I don't believe anyone has that right. But practically speaking, I think once you give anyone, either a person or an institution, once you give them power over everyone else, or anyone's life. Let's just say we're talking about the power of taxation. Let's say we're talking about taxes. Once that institution has the power to take your money, whether you want them to or not, why should they ever be accountable to you? Why should they ever do? I think this is sort of one of the core misconceptions or lies, actually, about politics, that we can never get the politicians, you know, if we just got good people in there, if we just got our people in there, things would be so much different. But the problem is the structure. The problem is that you've got this institution that is by design not accountable, because it has this power that it can take from you whether you want it to or not. You really don't, you know, they'll tell you that voting is the recourse. Voting is your way of holding them accountable. But I mean, just, you know, is that true? Does that match your?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, I think that voting is largely a sham and democracy is a sham, especially nowadays. but I would say that the way to, you need checks and balances in order to keep any power structure in check. You need ways to hold them accountable,
right?
Take them to court, lobbying groups, organizations to protest injustice or corruption. These are the ways that I would do it, because I think that the alternative is just not to have a power structure at all, or taxation, the example you gave. But then how do things get done in society?
Well, how do they get done before taxation? I mean, in my country, everyone's always saying, oh, God, you know, thank God for the income tax, because now we have public schools. Well, people educated their kids before we had the income tax. And we had roads before we had the income tax. In fact, the early roads here in America were built by private people and companies. So I think it's a falsehood to think that this is the only way that we can create these things. And also, you know, just the fact that when the government does take taxes to create something, it's inevitably screws it up. You know, I could give a million examples, you know, the war on drugs or national defense or welfare, everything it touches, again, because there's no accountability. So they'll take your money, they'll build some, you know, big welfare infrastructure, and then treat people like animals and create dependence rather than a system by which people can lift themselves up. So I feel like, you know, whatever kind of system you're talking about, there has to be accountability. And I don't think you can have that at the same time you have a monopoly on power.
You see, I think the problem is government corruption, corporations. Government corruption tends to be because of bureaucracy and greed, the ego of individual bureaucrats wanting to expand their remit and whatever. You see, this is why I believe in ethno-nationalism, because I think this is look at, you used the example of Japan.
Incredibly corrupt country, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
but
yeah.
You said it worked very well, though.
It does. It's you know, as someone living there, you know, as a young woman, I could walk across the city after midnight and not feel threatened. There aren't a whole lot of cities in the world you can do that. It's a very safe, beautiful, wonderful place to live, and it's massively corrupt. I mean, the construction industry is one example. You know, they basically buy off the politicians. The reason, I don't know if you remember the Kobe earthquake back in 96,
yes.
I think it was. I was in that. That was like my big earthquake in Japan. And there were some huge structures that just fell over. And it came out afterwards that they hadn't been built to code. And the reason, I think this was speculation on the part of the person, I don't know how you can document this, but what the commentators were saying was it's basically because the construction industry is in bed with the government. They don't need to, you know, they pay the right people off. They don't have to build things to code. And so this stuff just, so that's one example. It's not, I interviewed a former head of law enforcement in U.S. law enforcement in Asia once, who said the most corrupt countries on earth are the U.S. and Japan, because it's not that you're paying off the customs guy or the traffic cop or little, you know, people on the streets. That doesn't really exist there. It's all at the top, and it's very well organized. You know, even so, the country, you know, works beautifully. So, yeah, I'm not sure what to make of that.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the ethnocentrism that they probably feel, yeah, we're going to make some extra money here, and it's corrupt backroom deals and whatever, but we can't screw over the Japanese people because they're our people. I mean, that's what I would surmise is going on there, so that the end result is still something.
And what they did with the construction stuff, I mean...
But still, you've got a highly functional society. I mean, another part of this might well just be Japanese nature. I mean, I don't know if you...
And I think part of it also is that it's, they don't have, for whatever reason, they haven't developed like the massive welfare state that we have here. A lot of things that we consider to be, under welfare are, corporations really take care of their workers, and there's much more of a local sensibility, like you're kind of responsible for your neighborhood. I think they still have, like in Hong Kong, there's a lot of mutual aid societies. There are a lot of groups for specific interest groups. And so a lot of what we think of as welfare in the US that's been really taken over by the state is still kind of in private hands there. And so they just haven't been taken over as much. And a lot of that is, I think it is traditions that have gone back for thousands of years. I mean, it's a much older culture, certainly than American culture. And not that they still live the way that their ancestors did, but a lot of these traditions and the relationships come from deep roots. And, why would they change that? Why would they? Yeah, I think there would be a lot of resistance to coming in and saying, okay, we're going to have the state handle all this stuff now. And I'm just guessing too. I don't really know why.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, the reason I said about ethnocentrism is I think there's always this, an ethno-nationalism. I mean, I don't really talk about this very often nowadays. In fact, hardly ever talk about it nowadays. I think this is actually the first time I've really talked about it on Millennial this year, but it's come up. It is a bulwark against corruption. Obviously, it's never going to be perfect. But if you have a sense that, well, I can't screw over my people, they are my people, it would be a matter of shame for me to do that, then you're not going to do it. Whereas if there is individualism, then, well, why shouldn't I screw them over? I'll get away with it. It's far easier for people to just be tempted, especially if there aren't the checks and balances.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. And on if we're talking about like small, I don't think what you're talking about could work in something as big as the United States, because it's just not true that we have the same national identity. As much as to the extent that there's a national identity here, it's a really stupid one. So it's not, it's kind of hammered into our heads that, yes, we're all Americans, USA, USA. But the reality is our politicians are so far removed from us. Even in California, the California politicians are so far removed from me. They don't feel I'm sure they don't feel any kind of responsibility to me just because we're the same ethnicity or because I'm in their state. Or, I mean, these are criminals. They're just criminals.
Yeah. Well, again,
I can see what you're saying. If you have a group of people, whether ethnic or some other, religious maybe, or libertarian, get a libertarian group together that has this sense of connection to each other and responsibility to each other. I think that's a natural way of living, is that people do have that, and that those relationships and those groups have been sort of torn apart and replaced by the state, at least in the Western world. So I see what you're saying. But I'm still, and I think maybe, as in the case of Japan, Japan's wonderful. And if we could, replicate something like that, even though I don't fully approve of it ideologically, I would say that works and it meets my definition of civilization, because it creates a place where people can thrive and can prosper. And not just in the material sense. But I'm not comfortable with a setup whereby because there's still not real accountability. You're counting on them having this sense of goodwill to the population. And I feel like any system that's dependent on the goodwill of the person in charge, that's a fatal flaw. That's, you can't really count on that. What you can count on are real checks and balances, or some kind of real systemic thing that prevents them from having power. I mean, this is why I'm a cryptocurrency enthusiast, because if it lives up to its promise, and I'm not 100% sure that it will, but if it does, if you can take the power over money away from the state, if you can take their power to control what money is and to steal our wealth basically by inflating it, then that's a real check on their power. Even if they exist, that's a real check. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, like real things that we can put in place, or even, you know, reinstating common law. As an example, you know, even in California, there were some sheriffs that refused to implement the lockdown orders, the mask mandates, all that stuff. And they were within their rights to do that, because here in the US, the law stops with the sheriff. The sheriff's the one who decides, am I going to enforce this or not? Am I going to ask my officers to go out and arrest people for not wearing masks? Or am I going to say this is bullshit and you guys do what you want? And so that's another thing where it's like a real, it's an institutional check that might actually work. So that's the kind of thing I'm looking for. Real things that can really limit power, as opposed to voting, which doesn't limit power, or, you know, getting somebody in there who we think is going to have the right mindset. Because remember, they're going to be come at from all directions by people who want them, who are going to throw tons of money at them to do what they want them to do.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sounds like you're very wary of power in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, of course it's power, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm more sympathetic to power, because I'm more open to the possibility of non-corrupt use of power. I think that you seem to think that it's always unjust. It's all like, I mean, I think that human societies just need power. They need a power system.
And by power, you mean like someone ruling?
Well, authority.
Authority. Yeah. I agree that there are a lot of people who want that and who maybe even need it, who can't function well without it. I don't really believe that's true. I think it's more in their minds. And I'll just give you an example. You know, I lived in Hong Kong for like 7 years, and the vast majority of the population of Hong Kong at that time and now too are people who either they or their parents, in some cases maybe grandparents, fled communist China to come live in this British enclave. And, you know, you can say that, well, someone who was raised in China and especially indoctrinated with the communist indoctrination stuff is not going to be able to function. They need authority. They need someone to tell them what to do. And yet these people came over to Hong Kong and completely thrived, were able to figure it out. And yes, there was, you know, there was a British system there, but it's the most laissez-faire place you would ever, you know, much more free than any place in the US. And I would say, you know, the court system there was when I was there was pretty good. And so they did have this common law foundation brought over by the British. And these people who maybe even believed themselves that they needed, you know, some leader to tell them how to run their lives, when put in that situation, they didn't. So I've seen other examples of that in other countries where people who you'd think were so indoctrinated that they couldn't really function on their own, they do just fine when you take away the communism or whatever, you know, whatever it is they're living under.
Yeah. I mean, I believe that the Chinese are very given to authoritarianism, whether it's dynastic power or communism. It seems to be something that, or now with the CCP,
yeah,
which isn't exactly communist, but it's very authoritarian.
It's, yeah,
it they just don't seem to, as a nation, as a race, they just don't seem to be interested in liberty in the Western sense.
And yet they function very well in, I'm going to call it a libertarian enclave. You know, they function very well. And, you know, maybe they don't care about it in an intellectual way, but at the same time, they risk their lives to get there.
Yeah, I can believe that there are people who want. I mean, especially when it's going to be, well, the alternative to that moving to that libertarian place is to stay under communist, like vicious communist rule,
and probably die.
Yeah, I mean, didn't they? I think they killed 20 million people.
The Great Leap Forward, when I was in college, I was told like 34 million, but I think it's been revised upwards. It was in the tens of millions. Yeah, it was a massive. Well, here's kind of what I think. I don't think that my hope is that I don't think there's going to be one solution that looks identical from place to place. I think our big task is really we've got this group of people that wants world control, and that's what we're up against. I feel like we really don't need to agree about what the solutions are going to be. I mean, I've got my ideas. There are other people I've spoken to with ideas, and I just don't think it's going to look the same. I feel like it's a little bit like after the fall of the Roman Empire, when Europe was just so fragmented, and that was a great thing because all of these individual localities can grow and thrive. And if you don't like the one you're in, you can move and go to one that fits your values better. I'm hoping that we can create something like that.
Exactly. I mean, all we need to agree on is that we don't want the global tyranny that is unfolding. I mean, I think we can easily agree on that. No matter what doubts we may have about other things, it's clear that we don't want that.
Yeah, and just to sort of bolster your position a little bit, you know, let's say you did have this little millennial woes authoritarian regime up in the mountains somewhere or something.
But just to be clear, you know, I like liberty as much as the next person. You know, I'm not obsessed with telling people what to do all the time. I just
To me, the problem is setting up a system by which someone who maybe doesn't like liberty as much as you do can come in, because it's not just going to be you. You know, a generation down the line, two generations down the line, it's going to be other people. Is your system going to withstand that time? Is it going to be good 10 generations down? Is it going to be solid enough so that if some jerk who wants to take over the world gets into your position, are they really legitimately thwarted from doing so?
Here's why I would say ethnocentrism is the answer here, because if you tell people priorities can change over time, and maybe your priority is capitalism or economic wealth, prosperity, well, then someone can say, it's more economically efficient to offshore our jobs to China or Africa or India and just fuck our own people. Whereas if the creed instead is we have to look after our own people, that is always the priority. So anything that we do, we have to judge how will it affect the people of our country. Then everything gets judged on that basis.
But and how do you enforce that?
Well, I'm just saying, as a creed, as a constitution, I would absolutely put that in the constitution of any country. That it has a core group, and the objective of that society must work to the benefit of that group, because otherwise you're leaving it to the winds of fate, and you're saying it could be capitalism, or it could be a religion, or it could be a political communism, or anything. And at that point, well, okay, let's import loads of people who have that political persuasion, and again, fuck the local people,
or get someone to come in who twists it around to look like all the stuff that you're talking about really is for the benefit of the people. Which, you know, you could make an argument that it
indeed
is.
You could always lie. I mean, people could always be misled.
Yeah, and say, hey, so to me, that kind of question is really more about.
But then that would apply to any other system as well. Yeah. That weakness would be there with any other system. I mean, they say to us now, we're capitalism, prosperity, but this will be good for you. Don't worry. Okay, you'll be unemployed and in despair.
Or you'll be working 12-hour days just so that you can, have a tiny little apartment to come back to and all that stuff. Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I like the value that you're pointing at, but I feel like what's really needed is, it's not enough to say that. It's so my dad passed away 2 years ago, and he had been a professor of law, and one of the things he taught was constitutional law. And one of his famous sayings was, the Constitution is that document that prevents the government from doing all the terrible things it does. So it's not enough to me to put something in writing, or even to get people to sign it. It's, you've got to build, you've got to
the whole thing. The culture has to have that as one. It's absolutely. If it's just in writing, then you've got, well, that's the letter of the law. Right. But the spirit of the law can always be ignored.
So then how do we keep the culture alive?
Well, that's something that I don't think there's an absolute way to do that. The only thing you can do is have it in the culture that this is a core thing about us. We recognize our identity, our group, and our right to exist. And,
Can I do a gratuitous plug here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so because I have some ideas about this. So this is... hold this up. This is our private membership association, and which I think ties into what you're talking about. But my point with this is the education arm of our private membership association. And one of the things we're aiming to do, and it's not ethnocentric, and it's not really, if it's about a culture, it's about Western culture broadly, I guess, or about the values. I mean, we do talk about common law. We talk about, we do English literature, we do Austrian economics. So we're trying to keep these things alive. And, it may not be exactly what you're talking about, but we're creating a thing, bringing kids in and saying, hey, this is something you need to know about. This is, you need to understand the difference between common law and statutory law. And you need to understand that your rights don't come from the state. They don't come from someone else declaring that you have rights. And so, I don't think there's one overarching solution to this, but I think there are a lot of things that individuals can do to bring that back or to revitalize. The way I look at it is that our, when I say culture, I don't mean like a specific culture, but our connection to our culture and our connection to our own lives and to our creativity has been subsumed. We're, if the global elites have their way, we're going to be nothing but consumers and spectators. It's like, that's what, we're their, in their view, we're their livestock. We're consumers, we're spectators. We don't have agency in our lives. We don't create things with our own hands.
It's worse than that. In their eyes, most people are livestock, and you and I are troublemakers.
True.
So, okay. I mean, we would be the ones in the gulag.
They get called, yeah. I try not to think about that too much.
Yeah, so do I. But I know what you mean. Would you like to speak more about the fellowship, the mutual aid society? Because I think that's a useful thing for people.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people don't realize, I mean, when I was in high school, I was always told that, without the state, old people would be dying in the streets. And, if you advocate for freedom, that must mean that you just want atomized individuals not caring about each other and, the rugged individual type of thing. What I learned much later, partly because of personal experience, is that we have this long tradition of mutual aid societies, of people coming together, usually either around, it could be ethnic groups. In America, a lot of it was immigrant groups. African-Americans had a lot of them. Workers in different, port workers, dock workers, steel workers, people working on the railroad, people who had something to tie them together would start these mutual aid societies. And they functioned kind of as insurance. They functioned as welfare. So there would be orphan and widows funds. There would be, if you're injured at work, there would be a fund. And because they were administered, and it kind of gets to what you're talking about, where there wasn't really room for corruption because it's this group of people that have this common interest. It's small enough that everybody, even if you don't know each other, you kind of know each other and you know the culture. And you also know that it's your money going into that fund and you don't want it to go to someone who's trying to scam the fund. And so there wasn't a lot of people taking advantage of it. There wasn't corruption. And because it wasn't a political organization, it was this voluntary group, you could kick the leaders out if you didn't like them. So these were very widespread. And one of the things they had was a lot of them would have a lodge doctor who would come to the lodge and would, like, one day of the week or something, and all members could come and get free medical care. And then for, small amounts of money, there would be house calls and that kind of thing. This was totally wiped out, or mostly totally wiped out, when the AMA came along and the big insurance companies, and they used the state to get rid of this stuff. My grandmother lived in one of the last mutual aid homes in this country for the last 8 years of her life. So the way it worked was she lived in this tiny little town in Nebraska. She sold her house, which at the time I think went for like $15,000, not a ton of money. What she sold her house for would probably have bought maybe a few months in a commercial facility if she was going to go live in that. Instead, what it got her, because she was a member, she got to move into this home, which was like a real home, not institutional in feel at all. It was all women. It was a mutual aid society for women, and old Victorian renovated house where they had their meals together. They had an amazing standard of care, just a wonderful place and a community. It wasn't a bunch of people just living in their rooms isolated. It was really beautiful. And she was cared there. The deal was, if you can kind of get around, if you can sort of take care of yourself when you come in, we will take care of you for the rest of your life. You could have a stroke the next day and you're taking care of the rest of your life. So little by little, the state has sort of eaten away at that too. That house still exists, but they've kind of been forced to go on Medicare, and they're eating away at that group's ability to provide what it was able to provide. So what I'm aiming to do is, through the vehicle of private membership association, recreate that. So create care homes, our daughter has special needs and she's going to need care for the rest of her life after we're gone. And so we've long had this plan to create like a community where a living community where she could live and be cared for. And there would be this system for bringing in people who could be trusted to take care of her and others as well. So it wouldn't just be her. COVID kind of changed all that. We've changed the design of it a little bit, but we are planning to build this living community that will be for people with special needs and for the elderly. And it'll be following the old mutual aid guidelines. And, anybody can do this. It's important to understand the law, because you don't want to get in the position that, like my grandmother's house did, or that places before that did, where they were able to be shut down by the state. So it's important to do it, understand what you're doing, understand the law, and get advice. But people are starting to do this in my country. There's a couple up in Northern California who's creating a PMA outpatient care center, not a hospital, but like just a medical center where people can go to get treated for some emergencies, broken bones, things like that. And this is what we're going to be doing. And I think it's what we all need to be doing, because just on, forgetting about sort of the grander visions of what kind of system we want to live in or live under, the nuts and bolts of this system are falling apart. Hospitals are becoming places where people are afraid to go, and with good reason. And I have like stories from people I know, who, one friend who lost her adult daughter in the hospital system. Her daughter's like 20, 21, 22. And she was basically taken and committed into a psych ward without the mom knowing, without anybody knowing. She had to hunt her. I mean, these kinds of things are happening more and more frequently. And we really need to be building alternatives that treat people like human beings.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something where a large bureaucracy is, whether it's state or private, actually, can be very dehumanizing. And it just sort of naturally is. I mean, obviously, there are always good people within it who are trying their best. I've noticed this with both state and private, that there are good individuals. But the overall culture tends towards dehumanization.
And the bigger it gets, too. Like the,
yes, exactly. You know, yeah.
I think that happens. Yeah, that happens with anything, public or private. It's like the bigger you get, the more successful you get. And then, you know, it's like then there's, you know, if you're serving 1 million people, you need to be that much less concerned about the welfare of each individual one, because, you know, incrementally, each one is maybe not that, if just from an economic standpoint, if they leave, if they're not a customer anymore, it's not that big a deal as if you're only serving 12 or 20 some. So yeah, it's exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is something that people can look into. I mean, as you said, you need the legal help, and this is always, this is the trouble with any project. You need to know, am I doing this operating within the law or not? Because it can really trip you up.
And I should just say, on my blog, if you go to www.brettany.com, I do have an interview with one of the guys who, Mike Colombe. It's like, it was a recent interview I did with him where he talks about a lot of that. And he also, I can also sort of point you to some websites. I think I posted some websites on that entry for places to start for researching the legality and doing it right. Cause, please don't take this as legal advice. I'm not qualified to do that.
Oh, that's okay. I think people understand. Okay. There were several questions. Hold on a second. Somebody, Atlas Rain Axis, said you shouldn't feel bad about moving from California. It's a natural instinct to circle the wagons.
Yeah, well, if I could just say something about that. I the only reason I feel bad is that I'm still leaving some family behind. You know, my mom is here. We just lost our dad 2 years ago, and I did not want to leave her. She won't come with us because one of my sisters is still here. So, you know, it's never easy to leave. It's easy to leave when you're young and single and you don't have family and all that. But once you've kind of put down roots, I know we're doing the right thing, but it's still hard. There's still, you know, it's still not easy.
Yeah, of course. All right. Oh, somebody asked me, would I accept the position of streamer, live streamer laureate in a future? Yes, I would. Yes, I would. I think that's quite amusing. Okay, Gus Faye said, you will always find examples of corruption anywhere, but a system is never the answer. The answer is always in the people. The best check on power is social and ethnic solidarity. Yes, he's one of my regulars. So as you can imagine, he's of a similar mind to myself.
Yeah.
Atlas Rain Axis said, I work in a hospital and I see firsthand that all the charity care ends up going to illegal immigrants rather than to poor white people who need it. And this is a thing. It's the same in Britain. It's similar where people come in from poor countries from all over the world. And for various reasons, some benign, some malicious, our welfare budgets go to them rather than to our own people. I mean, again, it's just it's the very opposite of what I was saying earlier, where you look after your own first.
Right. And that's kind of why that kind of addresses the whole mutual aid as a solution kind of addresses that, because it's groups that form, and it doesn't have to be ethnic. It can be, you know, whatever whatever group you have, you know, dairy farmers or something. But you, if you're part of this mutual aid society, you guys are the ones who decide who gets the payouts. It's not some faceless bureaucracy that really, and it also gets back to the thing of, you know, if you can take people's money without their permission, then you can kind of do whatever you want with it.
Yeah. Okay, Vingul says, very much enjoyed hearing a chat with someone who is not in our sphere. Regarding the question, how do, because most of my guests, well, actually, quite a few of my guests there's been a variety this year. Read the question, how do we keep the culture alive? I think the answer is to keep it relatively ethnically homogenous. Some cultural exchange is good, but too much waters things down and will ultimately create global homogeneity. And this is the whole thing about if the borders are open and everything is just constantly buzzing around, eventually you end up with a sort of a soup of the same average mix everywhere. And this is something that, you know, I've noticed that, you know, diversity in France is exactly the same as diversity in London and diversity in Berlin. It's mm-hmm. always the same result, and you completely lose the local culture that was there before.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, getting to your point about it maybe being deliberate, there's something that often I think gets left out of that discussion, because when I look at immigrate, like, quote unquote, open borders in Europe, it's more than just open borders. It's actively subsidizing these folks. And, you know, I don't think we know what it would look like if it was just open borders and people had to come and pay their own way and not piss off the people they were, you know, working for and living around. I think, you know, you might still be opposed to it, but I think it would look very different from what we see in Europe. And you know, to me, when I look at the European policies, it's like, well, that just looks like a deliberate attempt to destroy something. That's not...
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's not something I follow closely, and so I'm wary of, like, making grand pronouncements about it, but...
Well, it's interesting that you would look at it from a sort of outside, fresh perspective and discern that, because it is. I mean, you just... But this isn't something that... I don't want to swamp you with stuff, but, I mean... there clearly are interests that want to destroy Europe. I mean, there's,
right. And,
there's
and,
no doubt.
And
right.
I would just to defend open borders a little bit, I would just say, you know, it's not what you're seeing there is not just open borders. It's really like paying for an army to come in. It's giving room and board. And anyway, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But I also just wanted to address that you said nice to hear from an outsider. Kind of the way I see this past year especially, and sorry, my cat's going to run in front of me in a second, but I feel like we're all like all of society in the West anyway, and maybe worldwide, there she goes. It's like we're all sort of sitting on top of this sieve, and these past couple years have like been shaking the sieve, and some of us have sort of filtered out, some of us are filtered down. But we've filtered down from all the different groups, all the different ideological groups. And so we're kind of finding ourselves with strange bedfellows. So I find that I'm like, I feel like, you know, I was listening to some of your other guests, and so much of what some of them were saying just really resonated for me. And sorry about my camera. I blame the cat.
That's okay.
You know, so much of what you're saying, you know, I'm sure there's a ton we disagree about, but so much of what so many of your guests were talking about just really resonated. And there are also some people on, you know, from the left who like really, you know, get it and understand the nature of what it is we're up against. And so I feel like, you know, we've all kind of, there's a small number of us that have trickled out of this sieve from all these different, you know, parts of the ideological spectrum. And now we're together and it's like, we're kind of confused because I feel like the old labels don't mean that much anymore. It's like either you get that we're up against this tremendous evil or you don't. And if you get it, then this is your tribe. And it may, you know, feel weird, but it's like that's the way the world has been divided.
Yeah, it's definitely a new situation now. Yeah, I don't know how to make that.
I'm trying.
I think. don't worry about it. It's okay.
Yeah,
But yeah, there's things have definitely been shaken up, and again, this is especially accelerated in the last 2 years. And I don't know what kind of alliances will emerge. I hope that they do. I really hope that they do.
I think they are. They already are.
Yeah. Because otherwise we're up against a juggernaut. And, you know, it's a very resourceful. It's very powerful. So anyway, well, let's end it there. That's been a very interesting stream. So thank you very much.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I've tried to arrange another stream for tonight to make up for the one that had to be cancelled. So Harper Perspective will be showing up in about 10-15 minutes from now. So just so that there are four streams tonight. In the meantime, this is Brittany Schaefer. So thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2021.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye for now.
Bye.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.